Hello, I'm Rich Stewart, and our topic is Hope, a Black Christian's Legacy, or a Christian Legacy. They forgot to put the question mark. I'm campus minister at Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio. Wilberforce is a predominantly black school. It's the oldest black-owned and operated school in the United States. And as campus minister at Central State, which is right next door, at one time they used to be United. Some other time let me talk to you about that history, because that's kind of strange, especially when we talk about separation of church and state. You can matriculate either through church side or state side, but you've got one diploma. That lasted from about 1867 to 1947. But about 6 years ago, I was over at the Payne Seminary Library. The African Methodist Episcopal Church not only owns the college, but they have a seminary there as well. And as I was wandering through the seminary, I wandered into the chapel, and on one side there are four stained glass windows, and they are the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. On the other side, the four windows were a little different. One was depicting William Wilberforce, who was a British abolitionist for whom Wilberforce University is named. One was the Right Reverend Richard Allen, who was the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. They had been a part of the Methodist Church in Philadelphia, and at one point in time in the early 1800s, they were asked to no longer kneel at the front altar for prayer in a Methodist church in downtown Philadelphia. And they were consigned to the balcony railing, which they had built. And he said, "If you don't mind, I'd like to finish my prayer, and then we shall no longer bother you again." And that became the impetus which started the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So William Wilberforce, the Right Reverend Richard Allen, and then Daniel Alexander Payne. Well, I'm in Payne Theological Seminary. We'll talk more about Payne and his personal history, but he was a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And then the final picture, where you would assume John Wesley would have a point of prominence, was not John Wesley, but Martin Luther. I found that rather significant. Reformation as opposed to the Wesleyan writing movement. Couldn't understand that. 6 years ago, 4 years ago, I was asked to do a project for the Division for Professional Leadership of the Lutheran Church in America, funded by Aid Association for Lutherans, called Black Lutheran History. They gave me a traveling budget and a research budget and 6 months to complete the project. 3.5 years later, I turned in the fourth draft, and that's kind of where I'm going to start out with, because the history of black Christians is not so much important at this point. As it is with many of our churches now, we're talking about an inclusive ministry. Obviously, for a lot of you, I'm certain that I'm probably the first black Lutheran you've ever met. That is significant in some ways for some people. For others, it's not. But we have a long, structured history as a part of this church. The history of black Lutherans goes back to 1666. Slaves had been brought into the country from as early as 1620. And in 1666, a man by the name of Emmanuel was baptized in a Lutheran church in New Amsterdam, now known as New York City. Somewhere around that same period of time, the early 1600s, the Danes settled the Danish West Indies. They settled it primarily for plantation work to bring sugarcane and make rum to ship back to Denmark. They also sent down Danish missionaries to minister to the plantation owners, and those plantation owners also then brought their slaves along with them. The oldest living and still standing Lutheran structure is still in the Virgin Islands and is still being used as a church today. The irony is the blacks in the Virgin Islands freed themselves much quicker than the blacks in the continental United States did, and the church in the Virgin Islands has been predominantly black ever since. 25% of the black members of the Lutheran Church in America are all members of the Caribbean Synod. The history doesn't end there, though. From 1666 on up into the 1700s, the missionaries and pastors of the church in New York City did missionary work, up and down the Hudson River Valley. The first church on the west side of the Hudson River in New Jersey was built on land given to the church by a man by the name of Airy Van Guinea. Airy Van Guinea was a freedman, black slave who had purchased his freedom, had found himself with some money and purchased land, and then gave part of his land to the church to build the church on the west side of the Hudson River. Two things happened. One is, Airy Van Guinea did not stay a freed man. He sold himself back into slavery. As was the custom at the time, slave traders would come north, find freedmen, take them back to the south, and re-enter them in slavery without their having any say-so in whatsoever about their lifestyle. To keep himself free and in the north, Airy Van Guinea sold himself back into slavery to some Quakers, and he continued his own lifestyle, owning his own farm, running his own farm, making his own profit. The church that he was built on the land he gave the Lutheran church cannot be found now. As it happens in our history, we couldn't find enough Germans to come over to minister to the congregation, so they brought in some Swedes. And some of the Swedes then became Episcopalians, and that particular church became a part of the Episcopal Church, and we no longer can locate it. But there was a good deal of work done in the South as well. One of the strange men that bobs up through history is John Bachman. Bachman grew up in the North, born in Troy, New York, educated with pastors in New York and Philadelphia, and did primarily most of his training at St. John's Lutheran Church, the church that used to be at 6th and Race in Philadelphia. Now that's important for me, but not for you. 2 years ago, I was asked to present part of my research to a congregation which was celebrating its 175th anniversary, St. John's Lutheran Church, Philadelphia. I didn't make the connection until I was walking in the hallways, and one of my college classmates was the sixth pastor in 175 years. And we were looking at the paintings of the previous pastors, and I suddenly recognized two of the names that had trained John Bachman. And suddenly realized I was standing in the, at least in the congregation, not necessarily the same building, but I did preach from the same pulpit. They moved the pulpit when they moved the church that had trained John Bachman. Bachman moved to South Carolina, to Charleston, started a church there. And in a couple years' time, his congregation had grown to somewhere around 300 to 400 white members. He asked permission from his church council to see if he could do some work with the blacks in Charleston, South Carolina, some of whom were free blacks and some of whom were slave blacks. In 4 years' time, he had a Sunday school that numbered over 200 in terms of the black Sunday school, and a worshiping congregation to match. Well, one of Bachman's goals was to send a black missionary overseas. He tried several times. The first was a relative miserable failure, but he was the first black man ordained in the Lutheran Church. Yehu Jones was sent north in 1735 to be interviewed and tested by the Ministerium of New York. As travel was in those days, he arrived at the end of the Ministerium meeting, but there were enough ministers still left around. They didn't run away from Synod conventions then, that they were enough to round to interview him. They decided to ordain him. They sent him back to Charleston, South Carolina to pick up his family, and he found himself interred under the Seamen's Act. He was a freed black slave who could be reentered into service. Well, after some finagling and some letter writing by Lutheran pastors, he was able to extricate himself and his family from Charleston, South Carolina, but he did not go to Africa. He went to Philadelphia instead. Started a church there, and we lose track of him for almost 9 years until he comes back to the ministerium for recertification to do some of the same work in New York City. Well, the ministers checked up on his record in Philadelphia, and it was jaded at best. They refused him that certification for work in New York, and we lose track of Yehu Jones. But 2 years after he sent Yehu Jones north, Bachman also found a young, scholarly man in Charleston, South Carolina, who at age 18 had started his own school, who had taught himself 7 languages, and had a school enrollment of 130 whites and blacks in a private school in Charleston, South Carolina. The young man's name was Daniel Alexander Payne, the same one for whom the school is named. Well, Daniel Alexander Payne had absolutely no desire to be a minister. Sounds familiar for a lot of folks that I know. He wanted to be a good teacher. He had a background which talked about his family being a part of the American Revolution, including his father being a part of the Revolutionary War in terms of Boston Square Massacre. He was raised by his grandparents and a great aunt in Charleston, South Carolina, and was apprenticed out to a tailor. Well, after 2 years of running his school, the South Carolina State Legislature decided to do something about the slave rebellions that were taking place. And one of the things that they felt was affecting the rebellions were the education of black slaves and black freedmen. And so they outlawed any black school, any school owned and operated by a black person, and also wrote laws disallowing the education of blacks in South Carolina. The law was almost specifically aimed at Daniel Alexander Payne. Well, Bachman, who was a naturalist, was also one of the resource people for Alexander Payne and his school. Bachman had written two books with John Audubon. Kept a very neat rose garden in his parsonage, and was an avowed expert in botany. Well, he wrote letters along with several other leading citizens of Charleston, South Carolina, to introduce Daniel Alexander Payne to Northerners. One of those letters was addressed to John Schmucker, dean of the seminary at Gettysburg. Well, Payne was still not convinced that he ought to be a minister. But he was convinced that by talking with both the people in the South and the North, that maybe, possibly, going to seminary would make him a better educator. He ended up being supported by the Mission Society of Gettysburg Seminary, which was a mission society of the students at Gettysburg. In 2 years, he graduated and was licensed by the Franckian Synod. He changed his mind somewhere along the line. The Franckian Synod was the only synod of the Lutheran Church to speak out against slavery prior to the beginning of the Civil War. 2 years later, in 1839, he was ordained by the Franckian Synod and served a Presbyterian church in Troy, New York. I'll never understand how the Lutherans could let that happen, as we never let that happen now. But he served the Presbyterian church for 2 years, and then became sick, which seems to be one of those things that happens to ministers, and moved to Philadelphia, where he came in contact with the Right Reverend Richard Allen and the African Methodist Episcopal Church. He had grown up a Methodist, so he wasn't unfamiliar with Methodist tradition or their ministerial practices. But he remembered very clearly the messages and the preachings of his black counterparts, who said that we have learned the gospel by going to church and by loving the Lord, and we have not let the learning of books interfere with our learning of the gospel. Well, as a person who stressed education, that always scared him. But Richard Allen and others in the AME church convinced him that they needed his particular kinds of skills in their church body. Eventually, Daniel Alexander Payne joined the African Methodist Episcopal Church, not without some kinds of unhappiness with the Franckian Synod. Apparently, somewhere along the line, they had helped to pay both his salary and some of his seminary education, and so they felt that there was a debt to be repaid, and Daniel Alexander, like most preachers, didn't have a whole lot of money, and he was unable to pay the debt. It wasn't until 1856 when his name was removed from the Franckian Synod rolls, but the debt was still there. After about 9 years in the church, they asked Payne to become a bishop in the AME church. He refused. 4 years later, he accepted their invitation. He then started the African Methodist Episcopal school system, which includes Wilberforce University, which he purchased, Payne Theological Seminary, and five similar schools in the South. It's one of the few black churches which has a consistent educational system. But he was trained and essentially educated by Lutherans at Gettysburg. Now, that's not significant until you understand my own personal history. I grew up partially in the Baptist church. My dad was Baptist. My mother's family was very much a part of the AME church, including during the 1940s, the bishop and dean of the seminary and college at Wilberforce was one Bishop Ransom. my mother's maiden name is Ransom, my great-great-uncle. So as I wandered through those hallways and saw those stained glass windows, lots of things began to happen. And as I began to do the research on the project, you understand those same kinds of touchstones. Bachman did succeed eventually. His third crack at it finally did end up going to Liberia, Boston J. Drayton. Boston J. Drayton, we don't know much about his ministry in Liberia, but we do know that he was the governor of a state called Maryland, which then became a part of the country of Liberia, and prior to his death, he was Chief Justice of their Supreme Court. So Bachman did not fail. All this time, from the early 1600s to the mid-1700s, into the 1800s, blacks have been a part of our church. At no particular time have we ever really had a separate synod, as many other church bodies did. The Colored Methodist Church breaking away from the Methodist Church during the Civil War, or even a fissure in our church, which we did have, but we've glued ours back together. The same John Bachman was the president of the United Synod of the South during the Civil War. One of the things that brought us back together after the Civil War was a new hymnal, which Bachman asked people to do. We are now finding that the United Presbyterian Church and the Presbyterian Church USA are now talking about that kind of merger, and their fissure essentially revolves around the Civil War. Ours were quickly healed after the war. But at the same time, that healing meant that we lost some members. We truly lost some members. The 1980 census of the church recorded no black members in the South Carolina Synod. But we know that in the middle 1800s, Bachman had over 500 in his own church. And that was about one half of all the black members in the South Carolina Synod. But in 1980, we had no black members in the South Carolina Synod. In the late 1800s, the Alpha Synod was formed, the only attempt at a black synod. Now, if I can find the real words for the Alpha Synod, because I can never remember. The Alpha Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Freedmen in the United States. It was formed by a man by the name of J.D. Kuntz with W.P. Pfeiffer as a secretary, and they were the only two members who could read and write. The rest of the pastors and the congregations were all a part of the Western Hills of North Carolina. They got their first support from the Tennessee Synod, then sought additional support from the North Carolina Synod, but did not receive any other assistance from any other place in the church. They became desperate, and finally they were referred to the Synodical Conference of the Missouri Synod and Associated Synods of Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, etc. The Synodical Conference sent in a missionary to interview them. The report reads back that he interviewed them with easy catechetical questions which they found difficult, and he did not find them all suitable for the ministry. J.D. Kuntz, which was the power behind the Synod, died of diphtheria. William P. Pfeiffer was the one person who could still read and write, and he fought the kind of change that was taking place by the Synodical Conference. He was removed from their roster of the Synodical Conference and found himself joining the Ohio Synod in the late 1800s and served to 1911 when he died in the area of Baltimore. But that was the only attempt at a separate synod. Blacks have been a part of all of our church bodies from about that point on. Our history is not one that we always take pride in. Some pastors have found that when they went into old churches, especially in the late 30s and early 40s, sometimes the churches were stripped by the white members who had left a congregation before it was turned over to the black congregations. Many of our men were found to be a part of missionary boards' minutes, but never invited to be a part or attend the missionary board meetings. One particular pastor, Louis Routet, was unmarried when he went to Mobile, Alabama. And once he met one of the young ladies of the congregation, he decided to become married. And living in the parsonage also meant living in the church, because his living room and dining room were used as Sunday school rooms. Well, after he was married, the mission board had to decide whether or not his living quarters were suitable for a married couple. And after much debate, essentially the minutes of two separate board meetings, they decided that they ought to give him more space to live in. Literally, pastors were moved from congregation to congregation without consultation. A letter or a telegram came saying that you were to be in such and such a city by such and such a date. That only occurred with the black clergy who served in black congregations. In many of the Synodical Conference congregations, the white ministers were members of the Missouri Synod. The black ministers were members of no Lutheran body. The white ministers had pension plans, the black ministers did not. But in the process of all of that, a healthy number of congregations were started in North Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Missouri, and other places. And as people from those areas moved and migrated to the north, other congregations were formed in Los Angeles, Tacoma, Washington, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and New York City. And each time that expansion took place, black members from those congregations sought out Lutheran congregations in the cities in which they went. Our history is just as imbued and instilled as is yours. One lady in the process of doing the project was asked to reflect on why she became a Lutheran. Her rationale surprised me. She said it was because of education. When she went to her pastor at a Baptist church and asked about biblical study, the pastor referred her to a Bible college that was meeting for which she would have to pay tuition. A young man knocked on her door one day and said he was a Lutheran pastor, and she said, "Before you talk to me about church," she said, "can you teach me the Bible?" "Yeah, I can teach you the Bible." "How much is it going to cost me?" "Nothing." From that point on, she and her family have been a part of the Lutheran Church. Now, I won't say that she has stayed still. She has stayed in Cleveland, but she's been a part of the Missouri Synod, the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church in America. Her movement has primarily taken place because of the way in which the school systems require her to be a member of a church, or so that her kids have all had parochial education from grade school through high school. But it's the neatest letter from Earlene Slaughter in Cleveland. Consistently, one of the ways in which the Lutheran Church has both attracted and educated people, whether black or white, has been through the catechetical process, teaching about the Bible, teaching about the church. And as people have come into the church, that is the one thing they have valued: the Sunday school education for their children, the Sunday school education for themselves. Now, in the midst of our current days, we sometimes wonder what happened to that focus and that emphasis. For many of our churches complain about the lack of Sunday school materials or the lack of attendance at Sunday school. But still, one of the things that has consistently attracted blacks to the Lutheran Church has been the educational models. In doing the research, some things obviously come to bear. What happens historically has to have some kind of meaning for me biblically. We've tossed this around in terms of our governing committee, which is working on the project, as to which biblical model is probably the most consistent. We've talked about the Exodus image of people going out from. But the one image that continues to occur to me consistently throughout the process, whether it's the way in which black pastors were dealt with and their ability to hang in spite of all the adversity, or the ability of people to give land to a church and then sell themselves back into slavery so they could somehow remain in their minds free, has been the biblical image of Onesimus. Now, there's no book called Onesimus. The book is called Philemon. It's a letter from Paul to a slave owner to ask him to reaccept back his once useless slave, who now Paul has found to be of use to him, And while Paul wishes he could keep that slave with him, he is sending him back to Philemon because he knows he is sending him back not as a slave, but as a brother. Now, if you're interested in more biblical exegesis about Philemon, there are two tapes in the tape library, one by Fred Schatz and one by Paul Wee. Both a little different, both taking a different tack about the importance of that particular small book of the Bible. If you ask me how many chapters it is, I think you're in trouble because it's only one chapter long. It's probably the shortest book in the Bible. Some people even wonder why it is in the Bible. It's once been said by John Knox and other scholars, not that they haven't been refuted, that Onesimus is important and the letter to Philemon is important because Onesimus was not only sent back to Philemon but was sent back to Paul and became a part of the inner cadre, the apostles. And in that position, he served the church and then was recognized for his service by being named Bishop of Ephesus. And from his position as Bishop of Ephesus, there was a real Onesimus, who then called for a gathering together of all of Paul's letters to the multitude of churches he wrote to. And so it was the Bishop of Ephesus who then brought together the letters of Paul, which helped us then develop, our churches develop, that body which we call the letters of Paul in the New Testament. Now, whether we're talking about the same man or not is up to question. But some people believe because that particular letter is part of that codification, part of the New Testament, then that Onesimus was also the real Onesimus in the letter of Philemon. But consistently, my history, both not only the personal history, but the historical record says that the Christian church has been a part of who I am, both in its goodness and in sometimes in its evil. But consistently, the gospel carries us through so that we can then once again consistently replace ourselves into the church, into the life of the church, into the body of Christ. Sometimes to be loved, to be cared for, sometimes to bring the gifts that we have, which are different from the gifts that others bring, and sometimes to be repulsed. But that's a part of the gospel. That's a part of the continuing nature of what it means to be Christian. That's a part of the continuing nature of what it means to risk. My title was Hope, A Black Christian Legacy or a Christian Legacy. My history says that I'm black. My faith structure says that I am Christian. And so in a sense, I've shared with you part of my legacy. But I'm not so sure that my legacy is any better or any different than the legacy we all bring. The one thing continually striven for in terms of doing the history was to watch our churches move toward justice. Not just for the black members, but for all members. The consistent movement, sometimes slow, sometimes painful, but still movement and growth. Hope is something we are given. It's a part of grace. It's a part of our faith. I think I want to stop there and leave it open for questions, both about the project or what it means to have your Christian legacy as well.
What are your plans for your paper? You want to publish it?
It's into the Division for Professional Leadership, and it's being edited by someone else. I'm tired of it. It's like a baby that was stillborn or overborn. It had to get out of the house finally. But it is going to be published by the Lutheran Church in America and then shared with all the Lutheran bodies. And the Aid Association will be a part of that distribution process. Exactly how, I'm not sure at this point.
Could
Could you tell us, or would you please tell us a little more about your personal history and personal pilgrimage? You mentioned the Baptist and where did you get to where you are now?
It's kind of strange. This is the first time my mother's heard any of this.
That makes it more honest?
I hope so. She may correct me on some details because I may be a little foggy now. But it seems as if my early life consisted of going to one church on one Sunday and another church on the other Sunday. And the AME church, when we lived in one place, was in the suburbs, my mother's hometown. And then later on, it was just the opposite. Baptist church was in the city, and I had to go with my father. I can even remember one year when there was a Christmas program that was scheduled at both churches on the same date, and one church changed it so I could be in both. But somewhere around the second or the third grade, my parents decided that this was ridiculous. Every Sunday morning, and I was going like this. And we literally shopped around for a church. I can remember going to Episcopal services, to Catholic Mass. I even believe my parents took me to synagogue once. I'm serious, we literally shopped around. And we ran into a man, Alan Youngblood, who was founding a mission church in Toledo, who happened to be musically inclined. My dad was a classically trained organist. And my father and mother could not agree to switch to one of their churches or not. That was out of the question. So we had to be a third option. And Alan Youngblood was the person who was able to pull together that option. At one point in time, my mother was president of the Altar Guild, my dad was the organist and choir director, and I was one of the two lead acolytes. So we kind of ran the church in a sense too as well. My parents were charter members in the church. And the church celebrated its 25th anniversary last year, Mom? Or 2 years ago. And from that, grew up in the church. Like any other kid. Acolyte, Pro Deat Patria Award, Luther League, all the officers, including president. And then got very active in Luther League. Federation prior to the merger. And then was on the executive board for the Ohio Synod and president of Ohio Luther League and on National Luther League Exec Board. And probably that was one of the reasons why I went to Wittenberg as opposed to Valpo or some other place, was that I wanted to stay in Ohio. So it's been a consistent growth process in the church with a lot of ups and downs.
I think there's a kind of a movement, at least in the ALC, in terms of starting parochial schools. Now, I see parochial schools in some ways being started in terms to resist integration of schools. Other people tell us by starting parochial schools we are assisting integration. What do you think about that?
Depends. It really depends. If I'm not right, Nancy, one of the forums in the next couple of days is it tonight or tomorrow?
Tomorrow night, Rich.
We'll be on education. My one consistent thing is that I guess personally I'm in favor of public education, and I've consistently worked to back it. At the same time, I also know that several congregations in Ohio, particularly in Cleveland, have moved toward a parochial system. Or actually reactivating the parochial system which was there. The Missouri Synod system has gone through some death and dying pains in a metropolitan area. But because the educational system in Cleveland, like any large city, it has some difficulties, and especially in the suburb of East Cleveland, it's probably the worst system in the country. And there at that point, if I had to move to that area, I would seriously consider parochial education for my children. And at that point, last June, I believe, the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church in America, and the Missouri Synod jointly restarted an elementary school that had once been closed. But from the very beginning, the staff was going to be integrated, the student body was going to be predominantly black. So there were other kinds of issues going on in that particular setting. Um, We've gone through it in Dayton, which is where I'm from. We have a whole host of elementary schools and a private high school. Fundamentalist in nature, a number of Lutherans attend. I have some problems with that, but I also see that people have a freedom of choice. I don't think that's always bad. And a number of the members of my own congregation send their kids to Catholic school, so it goes both ways.
Is your own church fully integrated?
That's kind of intriguing. When I went there, it was about 55% black, 45% white. It's now about 80-20, black-white. In the entire time I've been there, only one family moved closer to the congregation, and that's either black or white, and that was a white family who then really moved out of it. They moved to Portland, Oregon because he got transferred. The congregation tends to be middle class. We have a good number of engineers, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a good number of school teachers in the congregation. It's a highly professional congregation in some ways. And we have some real difficulty in terms of integrating blue-collar workers into our congregation, which is kind of strange.
Which congregation is it?
Westwood.
Oh, yeah. Do you mean you have a difficulty integrating any type of blue-collar worker into your professional level congregation?
Well, some of the people have a difficult time seeing the image. I don't go to church very often there. I'm a campus minister, so I'm 23 miles away every Sunday during the school year. And I usually show up on Christmas, Easter, you know, significant events. But, you know, it's kind of strange for me when I pull into the parking lot now and see Datsun 280Zs and Cadillacs and large Lincolns and Mercuries. And those are not the cars that the people in the neighborhood have. You understand that? It's an image. And while the vast majority of the people are black, there's an economic difference between the people who attend the church and the neighborhood which surrounds it.
Do you think the Lutheran church as a whole may have more of that image than it does a blue-collar image?
Actually, we're probably more of a blue-collar church, ironically enough. I think we tend to see more professionals in the suburban churches, but when we start talking about the vast majority of our churches, which tend to be 250 or less in membership, they're in rural areas and they're predominantly blue collar, they're not professionals. That's also part of our legacy too.
I thought it was interesting that the names of the black pastors in the journal. Had they at one time been slaves and had taken the name of their master as their own?
That's a good question. I don't know. Yehu Jones was a...
Well, Pfeiffer and Kuntz, I think you mentioned.
Right.
Those are the ones I think.
I'm sure that at one point they had been slaves, yes. But that's a consistent pattern as well. A number of names across the board. I guess I was really kind of surprised to see a Stottlemyre and this black face showed up. And the young man who's graduated from our school, who's house-sitting for us, his name is Stubblefield. More English than anything else, but still, John really doesn't even know what his heritage is in some ways. That was a consistent pattern. One of the ironies of slavery was that Lutherans were probably the least slave-holding church in the United States. It wasn't until 1740 that the state of Georgia allowed slavery. And the Salzburgers, a German area that moved there, a group of people from one area of Germany moved to Georgia, when they did own slaves finally, because of the economic viability of their farms, they tended to work in the same fields with the slaves, eat at the same tables with the slaves, dress just like the slaves, and people thought they were weird. I guess part of the irony is that one of our church fathers, Muhlenberg, his son owned slaves, but when Henry was offered slaves and also saw them for the first time in the South, said that it really will be a test of the gospel to see how God judges us when we try to own other men. And yet his son was a slaveholder.
The Quakers probably had more of a history of helping slaves, didn't they, and fighting slavery than any other church body.
They were also heavy into slave owning.
Were they?
Mm-hmm. Part of it was that whole story of Harry Van Guinea, that they would tend to own slaves to keep them from being shipped back to the South. In other words, they played the political system to the benefit of the people involved. They looked for ways in which to enact justice as a part of their looking at the gospel.
Is there much black history as far as membership in the
place? Ironically, no. And yet, consistently, their colleges have always been open to black students. And we have two in our area, Wilmington and Earl. And Wilmington College was a station on the Underground Railroad as a part of that understanding of what justice was to be about. I guess I want to raise the question, if you have history questions, that's not always the bad ones, but also are there questions about what your images of hope are?
Yeah, Oberlin, I think, was one of the first colleges to admit the black people.
That's correct.
Oberlin? Mm-hmm. I came in late. Where are you, student? Asked.
Central State University, Wilberforce, Ohio, which is right next to Wilberforce University, out of which part of that history then arose.
It was an underground station, too.
That's correct.
Yes, I'd like you to talk about hope and what you mean by that, or what you think we should all mean by that in relation to your subject.
Well, the subject for the summer here is the politics of hope. And in the midst of our world, our history, I think we bring a lot of things to it. One of the things I bring is my historical legacy. And in the midst of that, I still have hope. I'm not depressed about the world. I think there's a future. Sometimes when I talk with students on our campus, they go, oh, I don't want to talk about tomorrow. It may not exist. In my understanding of hope, for me, there will always be a tomorrow. There always is a next chance. There always is something to be looked forward to. That's part of the gift that God, I believe, gave me. And that's part of what I see in terms of the lives of the people who have preceded me in terms of being black Lutherans. That in the midst of a crisis where a pastor, the night before he shows up for his first worship service in this old Swedish congregation in Philadelphia, he walks in the next Sunday morning and the altar and all the pyramids are gone. The old Swedish congregation came back and reclaimed them, because they did not want them used by a black congregation. But he didn't close the door that morning. He opened the door and had worship service. It's that kind of change which talks about hope. In spite of the adversity, we still go ahead. In spite of that one little thing that happens, the building is not destroyed. In spite of the lack of an altar, God is still present. And that's what hope is to be about. You know, we have the same kind of history, and we also run the same gambit as do others. Some people would think that, I tend to be more high church, which is kind of strange. Alan Youngblood was very low church. Robin Skiles, who died this past year, was probably one of the Lutheran Church experts on liturgical style. I can never forget seeing Robin walk out of his church one morning dressed in cape, cope, and hat. And that was very much the style of his congregation. his kids knew what to do when they were asked to be crucifers and banner bearers and theraphers. They knew what the rituals were to be about, and they knew what their roles were. And yet at the same time, I can look at some of our other clergy who have gospel choirs and have a different style of worship altogether. But all members of the same church, all are having a distinct understanding of what hope is to be about, what our futures are to be about, and what our presence to be about. I think one of the things that has gotten to me the last 2 days while here is that consistently your style of living is under question. Whether it's just by going to the dining room and eating, the way in which we eat is to be put under question by the way in which they serve us here. And if there are two different styles, we're to look at those two different styles and somehow say, where is it that I can grow? And if I can grow, then I have some room for hope, for I have a new place to move to. John Schramm yesterday talked in terms of the same thing about thinking with. There are some ground things that we don't want to give up, some bases out of which we base our firm foundation. But we're asked to think with someone else in another style while here. And if we grow or change or modify or even just learn something new, then that's one of those visions of hope.
How do most black people respond to a very structured liturgy? And I ask this because I was in an Episcopal church in Tacoma, Washington, and it was in a black neighborhood, and very few black people came, and finally we sold the church. And a black congregation, the Marantha congregation, bought it. And it's been an enormous success where the organ was, there's percussion instruments and so on. I went back to be with them, and the whole place came alive. It was exciting. It was a praise the Lord congregation where we had been very formal indeed in the Episcopal Church. And I just wondered about structured liturgies for people.
I wish I could answer for all blacks. I can't.
No, I know. I mean,
the irony is, my aunt, who used to be Episcopalian, is now Baptist. My uncle, who used to be nothing, is now Episcopalian. My mother and I are still Lutheran. That about runs the gambit. I think really a part of it is an understanding of what's going on. If the environment for that is created, where people understand what the liturgical process is, understand its meanings, it doesn't matter whether it's black or white, then they can either develop an appreciation for it or say they don't want to develop an appreciation for it. They have that choice. One of the strangest things for me on a campus where the vast majority of my students are Methodist, Baptist, Pentecostal, Holiness, in 9 years we've had an increasing attendance at Ash Wednesday service. Most of them have no idea in terms of their church histories what Lent is about. But last year in two services we had 47 folks show up for the imposition of ashes. And I just kind of scratched my head and went, I don't know what's going on, because I really don't. But we spent some time explaining the process. We spent some time understanding what it means to be reverent, what it means to be able to not just give up something for Lent, but to look at it as a season in which we investigate ourselves and our response to God. And that's part of the educational process. So I don't expect them to, you know, go back to their local Pentecostal pastor and ask them to put the imposition of ashes on. But, you know, as long as they understand that that's a part of what I think is valuable, and also the reasons why I think it's valuable, I think when they come, they find some value in that for themselves. Whether they follow through with it beyond that particular point in time is another question.
Would you say that the kind of hope that you're talking about shouldn't say what you say. is, you know, you talked about it as having a place to go, something, some growth and development happening, even though the externals are not what you would have wished. And I think in my younger years, that's what I thought hope was. It was sort of wishing things were better. And you could have hope if it looked like things were going to get better. But it seems to me that maybe some part of the power of the Black legacy is to have hope when things do not look like ever getting better or ever changing in the externals, but still having a place to go, a place to grow, somewhere to move without those good wishes.
Yeah, as you were asking the question, the more one name that flashed through my mind was Martin Luther King. In a sense, a lot of what he was doing, people told him was impossible. People told him he was crazy to start the boycott in Montgomery. And the irony is when you see Rosa Parks the first time, she scared me. She stands about 5'1" and weighs about 90 pounds, soaking wet. And to see what one woman did because she was tired, and her hope told her was that the bus driver was not going to get her arrested, but she was not going to get up out of her seat because her feet were too tired to move to the back of the bus. That was the entire extent of her political statement that day. But it moved much beyond that. And when you can see what little things happen, whether or not they happen today, tomorrow, next month, next year, 10 years from now, the point is, somewhere in the midst of that, the gospel is still at work in people, and that's hope. I guess one of the hard things about having hope is that we always operate on our time frame, whether it's, you know, Eastern, Central, Mountain, Pacific, and we always have another time frame we have to deal with when we start dealing with hope, and that's God's time frame. And God's time frame is not always like ours. Sometimes it happens faster, sometimes it happens much slower. How many times do we say, well, I'm not ready to do that? You can't ask me to do that, God. Why not? It's his time frame. It's her time frame. But if we're open to hear the fact that there is some hope, then we're part of that body, we're part of the growing vines, we're part of the growing branches, we're part of the body of Christ. I think there's some other images about hope. And maybe they have to do with the seasons of the year. If you plant a tree, it does some strange things. But every year it comes back. And if we look at that as part of the body of Christ, we understand, you know, you are the branches, something's got to be the trunk. And while the changes take place in all of us, the hope is that spring's going to come. And new growth will take place, new branches will form, the root system will be further developed, the tree will have life in the way in which people see it. But in the midst of the deepest part of winter, that's not to say that life does not go on. I don't want to encourage you to come back for tomorrow and set your time schedule according to my lectures. But tomorrow we'll deal with the political Christian. That's a whole other ball game. It has nothing to do with my Black history. And what does it mean to be a Christian and a politician? Or is there such an animal? Who knows? Thank you.
Thanks.